Welcome to Eye on Horror, the official podcast of iHorror.com. This is episode 124, otherwise known as season 7, episode 5. I am your host, James J. Edwards, and with me, as always, is your other host, Jacob Davison. How you doing, Jacob?
Doing good. Just waking up on Sunday morning.
We're doing it a little later today. We got to sleep in.
Yeah, although yesterday was 4:20, so...
So was it really sleeping in? Also with us is your other host, John Correa. How are you doing, Correa? How was your 4:20?
Oh, I spent it at the Long Beach Grand Prix. So I didn't get stoned, but I did get sunbaked. So I'm still quite sun-dazed from that, which that shit's insane, dude. They don't have a track. They just close off like a section and they're just like going around like the convention center and aquarium and stuff at like
in the parking lot.
No, like the streets, like they, oh, the like streets. They do the okay. Streets. Yeah. And it was IMSA and like all those. So those were like, these were cars that were doing like 300 miles per hour and then doing like a 90 degree turn and stuff. That was crazy. I've never been in one of those. So that was a lot of fun.
They used to do, and I think they did this to keep people from doing it on the streets, but they would do drag racing out here in the Qualcomm Stadium parking lot when Qualcomm Stadium was a thing. They tore it down and they built Snapdragon, but Snapdragon's only used by the SDSU Aztecs because we lost the Chargers to you guys.
Oh, no. We took the Chargers from Crimea River.
And you took the Rams from St. Louis. Don't you guys just create any of your own teams?
No. And then you know what we're taking next? The fucking Olympics. I can't wait. No, I can wait. That's going to be horrible.
We're getting way the hell off topic.
Wait, is this a horror podcast?
Yeah. This is Eye on Sports. And we have a ton to talk about. This is our baby tomato episode because we're going to play catch up. Ha ha. You like that? We only got to tell one joke because we only had one episode.
No, we took a break at the worst timing. It was like right when everything came out. So
we were talking before we hit record that right after the last time we recorded, the big release was Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. Have you guys both seen it?
Yeah, I saw it.
What'd you think?
I actually liked it more than Afterlife. I thought it was pretty fun, and it did a better job of kind of doing like a Ghostbusters type story in that it felt like a big budget live action version of the cartoon. Like, you know, had your Ghoulies, had some ghostbusting, and it was set in New York.
I really liked it a lot. I you're right. It is more of a Ghostbusters movie. I think the reason for that is because Afterlife, I think they were trying to keep the original Ghostbusters not being spoiled, you know, but this one, you know, that everybody's there. So it,
oh yeah.
And I've heard a lot of complaints. It's kind of getting skewered by the critics, which I don't understand the hate for Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, because it's an entertaining movie and it brings out the new quote, new Ghostbusters, meaning McKenna Grace and, Carrie Coon and Paul Rudd, you know, the familial connection, the next generation, I guess you could call it. But people are complaining that it's all nostalgia. It's like, what do you expect from a Ghostbusters movie at this point?
Also, I felt it was less nostalgia hooking than Afterlife. Like, it did try to do at least a few new things.
Yeah, it's about the same for me. I mean, nostalgia wise, because they still, you know, I mean, they still played up the song. They still used Who You Gonna Call, true. You know, and Annie Potts was back as a Ghostbuster, which was pretty awesome.
I love Annie Potts.
But I mean, it was pretty much pure nostalgia. But the thing is, that's kind of organic because in that universe, the Ghostbusters freaking saved New York. And even if it happened 40 years ago, you know, when they reappear, people are going to be like, yeah, Ghostbuster, you know. So I don't know, the nostalgia didn't bother me. People, I think, just wanted something to complain about.
Yeah, because I mean, Ghostbusters are like the only ethical form of enforcement there is from a government agency. So like, of course people are going to be excited when they come back.
Yeah. Speaking of the government agency, the freaking the small dick guy is back too in this.
I always loved how he was the villain, and when you're a kid you're like, yeah, fuck that guy, but then you become an adult and you're like, He's not wrong. He's not wrong. Like that is very, we don't know the environmental thing. Was he right to just like open up the thing and re-unleash the ghost? No, no, but like,
but he had a point.
I mean, yeah, the looking back, the original Ghostbusters movie is very anti-environmental protection agency.
Yeah, although the funny thing is that in Frozen Empire, they kind of reverse that because plot point is the ghost trap is almost at maximum capacity and could explode. And when they ask why they didn't plan for that, Janine Melnitz even says, it was the 80s. We didn't think about the future.
I'm glad they address it.
Yeah, they do admit. Yeah, there was some faults in that logic. But I just saw it in theaters, thought it was fun.
Another thing that came out, it feels like forever ago, but this one's actually getting a little more love from critics. The First Omen. Oh, and I know we've all seen The First Omen.
Oh, yes.
Oh, let me tell you, first and foremost, y'all know me. You know I hate going to the theaters now because I hate people in it. But we saw it in one of those like AMC Prime fucking theaters, Prime format or whatever. And we were like second row from the front because it was so packed. So we didn't, but there was no one else in a row. So we didn't see or hear anybody. So that was an immaculate theater experience.
I see what you did there.
I didn't mean to. That's great. But for an immaculate movie, because Lindsay never watched the Omen movie. So we watched the first two throughout the week before seeing it. And
I binged the four, everything except the remake before going up to it. And that was an experience because the first one is really scary, but then they get a little cornier until four completely goes off the rails. Four is...
We don't talk about four.
Oh, I talk about four. I thought it was hysterical.
I don't talk about four. No, I love the original trilogy with all my heart, and revisiting two especially because Jerry Goldsmith did not want to do the same score again, but they were like, no, we have to have the iconic thing. And so what he did, like Omen, Damien the Omen 2 is like, is Jerry, like for the Omen, what Attack of the Clones was with John Williams. Because like you watch Attack of the Clones and all of a sudden you're like, wait, is John Williams using a fucking electric guitar in this? but Damien the Omen 2, what they were doing with the, like doing the crow thing, that's my only complaint about First Omen. Was I was sitting there going, I just need an and I think it was because I watched Damien the night prior. I was just like, I just need that one. But First Omen, I don't know if it was because of the marketing and like that they were just probably predominantly showing like we're doing like a 70s horror movie, but I was not expecting, like, there was so much with it that just made sense, where it's like, okay, you're doing a movie basically about Damien's birth mother, right? So like, of course it's going to be gyna horror, but like that didn't register in my head. And holy shit, did they pull it off? Like it looked great. They matched a lot of the aesthetics of like 70s filmmaking with like big wide establishing shots of the city. The acting was phenomenal. That one scene that was like, yo, you guys that were watching Possession when you were talking about this scene, I know you were.
God, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So fucking good. Like, oh, man, dude. Like, honestly, like, First Omen blew me. As a lifelong Omen obsessed fan, like, that's everything I needed from an Omen prequel, I think. And also, I got, you guys know, there's one shot. You guys can't see because I'm doing a visual thing, but the hand reaching out bit. That's going to be someone's album cover. I just know it.
That was pretty badass. But no, I completely agree. And I was fortunate enough to see it at the Vista Theater, which was playing it on film, which gave it even more of an authentic kind of 70s experience. And it really did draw on a lot of Euro horror, particularly from the 70s and 80s. You know, just if it was dropped years ago and somebody said it was made by Fulci or Mikhail Soavi, I could believe it. And yeah, it's because it definitely runs a bit harder, and there's an ample amount of gore and uncomfortableness, and the plot was actually very well executed. Because if you had told me, oh, there's going to be a big Omen prequel, I would have been skeptical, because like, what are you going to do with that? And evidently there is a lot you can do with that. And it was scary as hell. Like there were a couple of scares that actually did make me jump in my seat.
Oh, dude. I mean, so much behind it. It shouldn't have worked. Like, no. When you think of a horror prequel, it's like you're taking all the horror out of it. But they made it make sense with how it was, because it's all about, you know, like just getting to it. Just it made too much sense. And like Neil Tiger Free, the lead who played Margaret in that, she was phenomenal, dude. She did so much. Like I said, that one scene that definitely invoked possession. I was just like, holy shit. But even before then, dude, she would do little things with her face where it's just like, what was that? What was that? And I think my only real complaint was Bill Nye was phenomenal in it. But there was definitely one part where I couldn't help but just go, the greater good. The greater good, you know.
Nah.
My only complaint with it is I felt that the last act kind of dragged on a bit. I think it played its hand too early with the big twist, which by now everybody probably knows the big twist, but I'm not going to spoil it anyway.
Yeah.
I think it played its hand a little too early with that. And I think it could have, that would have been a bigger shock if the big twist kind of leads you into the third act. And I thought that the third act kind of dragged a bit once you know that big twist. But you're right. As far as horror prequels go, you're kind of like, what can you add to this? Well, turns out a lot because of the cool twists. You know, it doesn't actually tell you the whole story like you expect to hear it. So I enjoyed it a lot. And the middle part, after they set the whole thing up with this, you know, prospective nun going to Italy to take her vows, and then the twist, that whole middle section where it's an Omen movie is awesome. Yo. like you said, the Final Destination kind of stuff, and you know, when it is actually an Omen movie, you're like, okay, this is what I'm here for.
Oh man. And dude, just like the amount of like fresh talent in that movie that was just like on next levels between the filmmakers, the leads. I mean, Maria Caballero as Luz, the roommate, like she was just serving the entire time. There was a part where they were going out and she put on a blonde wig. I'm like, that's not going to work for you, girl. And then she worked it. It was just like, how dare you? When she gets like the full nunnery look, it's like, that's not going to work for you, girl. And then she served it. And I was just like, God damn it. You are bad. Loved it. I'm glowing. I loved it. That's all I needed, dude, to keep my life happy. It's just like a good Omen movie, and they delivered, which I don't know if I made the mistake of seeing the first Omen on a Thursday and then going to see Immaculate that Saturday, but I know everyone loved Immaculate, and I liked it. It was good. And it makes me wonder if Immaculate was this year's Talk to Me for me, where I saw it a little too late and everyone hyped it up so much. And then I had a bad theater experience because, again, it wasn't. That's why I say the Omen, it was Immaculate theater experience, but Immaculate, it was terrible. Dude, we had people fucking talking. There was this one lady, like, especially at the end, anytime Sydney Sweeney did something, she just got like really loud laugh. It was I liked Immaculate, but I think I need to revisit it again. It's similar with Talk to Me. I'm going to watch Talk to Me soon and give it a second shot. Cause like, I was like, I feel like I would love this movie more. Just this theater experience is horrible.
Yeah. This is why I am very careful about my time and location for theaters, especially stuff like Alamo or like Vista, NewBev, all that business. Cause hell is other people, especially when they're assholes at a movie theater.
Dude, even Alamo, we went and saw Godzilla X Kong opening night at the Alamo. And these people that were like to our left, a few seats down, were talking so loud. You like that. That's a loud movie. And we could still hear them. And
did you raise an order card and ask somebody to take care of them, like they say in the intro before the movie?
Absolutely. And the Alamo staff were really good and took care of it. But like, it was just like, dude, what the fuck? Like, this is the theater where you know you're not supposed to be doing this shit. Why are you doing this?
Again, hell is other people.
Hell is other people.
I actually haven't seen either Immaculate or Godzilla versus Kong because, well, Godzilla versus Kong, they didn't screen for press. And Immaculate, they screened it on the same freaking night as Love Lies Bleeding. So I haven't seen either. So what did you guys think of those? Why don't you guys talk about those for a few?
Well, first of all, boys are back in town. Godzilla X, yeah. Dawn. Let's go. Come on, Jacob. Yeah. Let's go. Let's go. Yeah.
No, I mean, I love Godzilla X Kong because I got into Godzilla in the Showa era, where it was a lot of team up movies between Godzilla and other monsters fighting other monsters, which to me is a perfect Godzilla formula. Like, I think Godzilla versus Gaia Gang and Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, like a lot of those from the 60s and 70s were kind of my introduction to Godzilla. So this is very evocative of those. And it, you know, it's classic setup plot where, you know, like last movie was Godzilla versus Kong, and you know, they kind of teamed up in that, but like this time, like they both have to work together if they want to save the world from the Scar King, is basically evil King Kong, who has his own like personal kaiju weapon. And you know, just you got a badass kaiju team up movie, Godzilla and Kong, you know, what's not to love? And I love Mini Kong, which again, you know, going back to the classics, it's like Godzilla had a baby Godzilla for a while, so now Kong's got a baby Kong. You know, it goes full circle.
What's the story with the power glove that Kong is wearing?
Oh yeah, basically Dan Stevens is the Ace Ventura kaiju detective / doctor. And at first he like Kong breaks a tooth, he helps repair the tooth, and then Kong's arm gets injured, and apparently they were developing a augmentation cast system in case Kong ever got hurt. So they bring that in, and it's basically like an exoskeleton power glove for Kong. So he's got a big ass metal gauntlet that he can just like smash shit with, and it's awesome.
Yeah, I was seeing that in the commercials, and I'm like, oh, what's the story with that glove? So there you go. Yeah.
No, they did a really phenomenal job of like laying down why things are the way they are. So like, because we did have Godzilla versus Kong in the previous movie, and then they talk about like, okay, so Kong is basically down in the hollow earth now, that's his territory, and above is Godzilla. So if Kong ever goes up there, Godzilla's gonna be pissed and come after him. And so they do have that moment where basically Kong's like goes up to recruit Godzilla to help with the Scar King, and I forget the new kaiju's name off the top of my head.
The ice kaiju, what is his name?
It'll come to me in a sec, but and so yeah, they do duke it out at the pyramids, which was really great. They also do like explain things like with the augmented glove. They explain like they were like, well, we know how to communicate with Kong. Kong's basically our guy, right? But what if he encounters something that he can't handle? So they started developing like how to augment him. But then the government was like, yo, you cannot make these things that we can't control stronger. What the fuck is wrong with you? And so they shut it down. So they only made one glove. And so when he injured his hand, convenient, it was the right hand, you know, that would have been awkward. But
maybe it's reversible. I don't know, but also the ice kaiju's name, Shimo.
That's right. Shoot, they were great. I really enjoyed it. It was literally, it's a WWE SmackDown. Like, yeah. It is kaiju's fighting. It delivers on all that. There's a bit of heart, you know, with everything. It ties together. They set up future. But I love just watching, like, seeing more of the personalities of the kaijus coming out. So like Godzilla has like a lot more like cat characteristics, like Ty West has been saying, like a lot of them are saying. So when he takes a nap after a battle in the Colosseum, it's so cute.
He's all curled up.
But I was really...
Also, Adam Wingard was at the Q&A for the screening I was at, and he said if he gets to do another one, he will have either Godzilla or Kong do a Stone Cold Stunner.
Hell yeah. Because they did was it a pile drive? The slump? Yeah, that was great. I was really worried about Suko, because I was like, all right, so... A, sick and tired of like baby versions of things. So the fucking baby Yodas and all that stuff. Like, I'm always a little weary of that. It's like, oh, you're trying to do a thing that's cute. But like, Ty West said that like he kind of viewed this more
I
as.
I mean,
like
Adam Wingard.
Oh, my bad. Adam Wingard. I always confuse those two. Adam Wingard said that like this was like a buddy cop movie. That's how they kind of like pictured like them. So like, yeah. One's the rogue, one's like kind of the more senior thing. And Suko is literally, he's not like someone's baby or something. Suko is basically like that one gang member that's not as strong as everyone else that easily gets picked on by the cops and becomes their informant. That's Zuko. Zuko is that little the informer that snitches on them and reluctantly becomes a part of the team later in the movie. You know?
Kinda, yeah. And also, I do love that when they introduce Zuko, that Kong, you know, tries to befriend him and be nice, and then Zuko attacks him with some of the other apes, and he literally beats the shit out of the other apes with Zuko and just, like, tosses him through a tree.
Yeah, no, Kong just picks up Zuko and just starts beating everyone with it. It's so good. But yeah, dude, it's fun. It's a kaiju mashup. I mean, like, it's great that we are in a golden age of, like, different forms of Godzilla being explored, where you can have the more Gojira inspired minus one, where it's very serious, takes on heavy themes, and then you get to turn around and have this colorful, amazing, like, just kaiju showdown WWE matchup with, like, the the crush on Dan Stevens that came back with that movie. only matched by his Letterboxd top four interview, where he was like, he did for Abigail, and he was like, oh, well, I got to give my top four vampire movies then. It was just like, Be Still My Beating Heart. Like,
yeah, Shadow of the Vampire, Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, Norway.
Oh, when he referenced Norway, I was just like, sweetie.
The other one that he did was Herzog's Nosferatu.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah, that's what made me blush. Yeah, that was the blush one.
Speaking of Abigail.
Yes.
Do you guys see Abigail? I know Jacob did.
I did.
Yeah, what did you think of Abigail?
I fucking loved it.
I loved it too. It's a radio silence vampire movie is what it is. So you know that they're going to subvert the tropes that you already know, but it also kind of embraces them. But it's oh my gosh, it starts off like Reservoir Dogs, but then it turns into like a slasher movie, and then it just goes. I mean, it almost goes full Ready or Not, only instead of a bunch of people hunting one person, it's one entity hunting a bunch of people, and there's just as much blood, buckets and buckets and buckets.
Oh yeah, so much blood. And it was interesting to me because it actually felt kind of like a modern update or Radio Silence's take on classic Universal monsters and the old This Old Dark House type of horror movies from Universal. Again, you know, it's under that banner because you got a vampire, you got a big creepy dark house that you can get easily lost to in a lot of different rooms. It is so much fun. And, you know, I watched it as blindly as I could, and there was still a lot of good twists and turns. And, you know, just it was definitely helped by such an amazing cast, including Melissa Barrera in the lead. And again, Jonathan's man crush, Dan Stevens, in a completely opposite role to Godzilla X Kong, where he plays like real hard ass with glasses and a ridiculous accent.
Yeah, he's like an ex-cop, and he's got like the cop accent, you know.
he's like trying to go for like more of a Brooklyn accent.
Yeah.
Did you guys know there's a third Dan Stevens movie coming out in major theaters this year?
Yeah. Oh, yes, I am quite aware of Cuckoo.
I'm very aware that there's a third Dan Stevens movie coming out. It's going to be great.
Where he has yet another ridiculous accent.
Yeah. the thing about Abigail is they kind of tell you once you find out what's going on, because it's more than just they kidnap this girl who turns out to be a vampire. It's like there's a reason they kidnapped her, because her dad is like, you know, supposed to pay this $50 million ransom. But no one knows who her dad is to a point. And then once they find out who her dad is, all of the kidnappers are like, oh, nope, I'm out. You know, it's like and then they're like, okay, wait, are you? You know, there's mistrust amongst the kidnappers. They're like, oh no, you're working with them for this. You're setting us up. You know, it's just this crazy exercise in paranoia because they get locked in. It's not just like they can just cut and run, leave. They get locked in with her. You know, oh my god, it's so good. Abigail, so much fun.
Just the rest. The cast is really solid. I mean, you got Catherine Newton, Angus Cloud, William Catlett, Kevin Durand, and Alicia Weir as Abigail. Like, she really killed it in every sense of the word. And just like all the ballerina stuff combined with the vampire stuff was very amusing.
The ballerina stuff that she would do as a vampire was very Megan-esque. you know, or excuse me, Mithrigan-esque.
Yeah, this is why we need an Abigail versus Mithrigan movie in the form of a dance-off.
A dance-off?
Have you guys been watching the Chucky series?
No, but I did hear about that cameo or reference.
Oh, dude. So they just came back for the part two of season three. I think it's in the second episode of part two. So the season split it in two. There's a scene where Chucky, because he's aging, that's the problem with season three, is Chucky is getting old and he's dying, and so he's just sitting there watching TV and he's flipping the channel, and every channel it's like the dummy from Dead Silence, and they're like, he didn't even get a franchise, wink, or the boy, yeah. And he's just like, you're just stealing my style. And then it's that scene in Megan where she's doing the dance and he's like, what the hell, she stole all my moves, fuck you, Mithrigan. It's great. That show is so tongue-in-cheek and just, like, great.
Yeah, I watched season one. I got to finish season two and then get on with the rest.
Well, and the brilliant thing about the Chucky series is Devon Sawa plays a new character in every season, and every season he gets killed, and so it's always like, how is he going to die this season?
Let's shift gears and go from fun movies to a very serious one.
Yeah, let's talk about how I saw the Rad at its 40th anniversary screening.
Hell yeah.
Okay.
Hell track.
Not exactly the direction I was going, but sure. Let's talk Rad.
That's right. I'm hijacking this transition. No, they did Fathom Events did an anniversary nationwide screening of Rad, which I saw over at City Walk, which was great. It's a great restoration. It's never saw Rad on the big screen without riff tracks going. So it was amazing. And as soon as the credits come up, all of a sudden this guy is standing next to me, just starts shouting. And it scared the fuck out of me. I jumped out of my seat and it was Bill Allen, the star of Rad. And he just goes, hey guys, stick around because they're going to do an interview thing after this. But after that, come across the street at the food court at City Walk. I'm signing autographs. And yeah, dude, Bill Allen, and it was cold, stood outside for like a few hours and signed everything for every person that went up to him, and it was amazing. Bill Allen is a goddamn mensch, and I love him. So, yes, I now have a framed signature for Rad sitting in my office. That's all I want to say. It's just
how did you know he was going to be there? If it was a surprise,
we didn't
to bring your but how did you bring your poster?
No. He brought stuff to sign for me.
Okay,
he had copies of his book. I think he had a couple of records. He definitely had a lot of like pictures to sign. But no, he was just it. And that was the funny thing is, again, this is a Fathom event. This wasn't like a repertory theater. We're the only person showing it. So I just happened to be in the one theater that Bill Allen was at and would do a signing after. And I had friends that were like seeing it at other AMCs or other places in town. And so I'm just texting them like, yo, Bill Allen was at my screen. And they're like, fuck, I'm in Sherman Oaks. There's not enough time to get there. So, yeah, it was a great night.
Where I was trying to steer us. is Civil War. I know you both have seen Civil War.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let's talk Civil War. What'd you guys do? This is, I mean, I love Alex Garland. I love everything he has to say. This is a grim movie. And the thing is, my big thing, when I accidentally saw the trailer before Love Lies Bleeding, you guys know I avoid trailers, but with A24 stuff, they give us tickets to paid preview screenings. So that's how we see it. So we have to sit through trailers. I was wondering how the hell they were going to pull off a Texas-California unity, you know, coalition with this. And the answer is they don't. And I think they did that to make it as apolitical as possible. So the actual focus is on the Civil War itself and not either side. By the end, you kind of get an idea of who is right and who is wrong. But it's also completely, you kind of get the idea that the president's a douchebag in this situation.
That's it.
Yeah.
But that's it, though, is that
they don't tell you what political party he's from. They don't they don't draw sides like that. You just know that.
Doesn't he have a name? They just call him the president. As Nick Offerman.
You just know that the rebels are, quote, right. You know, they're the righteous ones.
It's insane because I did see the previews and I was getting really worried because I was like, oh man, here comes this British filmmaker and he's gonna here's his opinion on American politics, like what kind of take, and then like no one was helping. The marketing for this movie has been a brilliant kind of terrible that's like insane, to be honest, because the trailers all make it look like it's going to be politically charged as fuck. More so than like what was that movie that came out in 2020? The Hunt. They made it seem like it was going to be as like polarizing as that. And then they came out with those AI posters, which were fucking horrible.
That was some bullshit.
It's all drawing attention to it, which is working because it was number one at the box office, biggest opening for A24.
It was number one box office twice.
Yeah.
In a week, 2 weeks. Like, that's the first for A24.
And then everyone is also going, oh, well, you know, with this movie, we're kind of saying both sides are bad and stuff. And so, like, I went into it just like ready to just like not be happy about the politics at all with whatever they were going to do. So the fact that the movie actually went so far out of its way to not do any of that, to just really set the grounds for like a neutral, like, listen, this isn't about politics. This is purely about the horrors of war. The theme here is war is bad and we're doing it through photographers. And you can't do that any other way than creating a fictional civil war in America. Because if you were to set that in like an actual war, you're immediately picking a side. And I was like, that's actually pretty fucking brilliant.
And actually, having the main characters be the war correspondents, you know, the photographers who are supposed to remain impartial. I say supposed to because the photographers did, but the guy that was Kirsten Dunst's sidekick or her reporter, you could tell that he was planning his interview questions for the president to be very leading. Yeah. So he kind of was in on the whole, the president is bad and K kind of a thing, but having the focus be the war correspondents who are supposed to be impartial kind of went a long way towards that, towards the whole, you know, not how it doesn't pick a side. It definitely knows how to ride a fence.
Yeah. Although my biggest takeaway from the movie was just establishing that if there were to be another civil war in this country, we are all fucked. Like, you know, you just watch it as they drive throughout the countryside, just pure decay, dead bodies and destroyed infrastructure and vehicles everywhere. And like Steve McKinley Henderson's character is even skeptical that when the rebels win, they may turn on each other. So, yeah, I mean, it's just if civil war happens at this day and age, it's not exactly like there's going to be any winners or just everything's going to be bad for everybody.
Well, and not just civil war, just war in general, because there was that really great scene where, you know, there's a sniper. And like they're sitting with another group and they're like, so who's shooting at us? And they're like, who are you trying to kill? And they're like, the guy who's shooting at us. Yeah, but what side is he on? Let me say this again. He's shooting at us, so we're trying to kill him. He's trying to kill us, so we're trying to kill him. Yeah, but what side is he on? Let me say it again. Like, just
the side that is shooting at us.
Yeah, no, but that's the fog of war. You don't know who you're shooting at some of the time. Sometimes those things get mixed up. And I just also really love that, like, because you have the two separate states and they have their own thing. They have, like, you know, the patches with the two stars and stuff. And then there's just Florida doing its own thing. And even like the news correspondents are like, the two staters are doing this and Florida's being Florida and doing its own separate. It's like,
and that's what they when and this part's in the trailer when they encounter Jesse Plemons' character, who you don't know what side he's on. And he's like, what kind of American are you? You know, where are you from? And the one news correspondent, he kind of lets out a breath. And he's all, Florida, you know, he knew that. Either way you slice it, being from Florida is not good.
Yeah.
You know, and the other ones are from like Missouri and Colorado. So they're kind of not taken aside. So they're safe. But the Florida guy's like, yeah, I'm from Florida.
Yeah. Also, got to give big props to Jesse Plemons because his scene was goddamn terrifying.
Oh, his scene was terrifying, but it's also led to one of my favorite memes that's happening right now where people are posting the picture of Jesse Plemons. What kind of aliens friend, alien fan are you? Are you original? Are you, do you like the first two? Do you think AVP was a proper prequel? Or are you more of a Covenant and Prometheus alien friend? Oh, I love it.
The thing that's scariest about that, and it, people are kind of overlooking it, but it's like when they when they first spot Jesse Plemons and his crew of people, they're disposing of bodies, and at one point one of the reporters asks the other ones, "Are there uniforms on those bodies?" And they're all, "No." You're like, "Oh, you know." So yeah. He's one of those Americans,
dude. It was really good. I was, like I said, I went in with I guess some bias of just like, ah, fuck, here we go. This is I got my ticket for free. So I was like, OK, here we go. What am I getting myself into? But no, I really enjoyed. Enjoyed is I was pleasantly surprised on what it turned out to be.
Enjoyed is a tough word to use for this because it's not the kind of movie that you enjoy. But man, it is
enthralling.
Yeah. Yes. So. Did either of you guys see Monkey Man?
I did.
Not yet.
Monkey Man, it was funny. They did a double feature for us, a press double feature of The First Omen and Monkey Man. And the funniest thing about that is the posters are almost identical.
Yeah, exactly. They're both like a figure exiting red door.
Yeah, a shadow at a red door. And I actually saw a thing on Twitter where someone's like, what room are these people coming from?
Another post I read called it the Mom, I Threw Up duology.
Yeah, it's the Red Door cinematic universe. Monkey Man is at first it's one of those what the hell's going on movies, you know, but I've never had so much fun in a movie trying to figure out what is going on. The closest comparison I think is Old Boy. People are saying that it's like an Indian John Wick, but it's more like Old Boy because he is it's like a revenge movie and you don't quite realize what he's seeking vengeance for until it jumps around a lot. But you don't, you know, another thing I've heard is people are saying Monkey Man is like Fight Club, and it's not really.
No.
I mean, he does these underground fighting where he wears like a monkey mask, but that's just kind of part of his training for this bigger mission he's got. But yeah, it's more like Old Boy in just how this dude insurmountable odds and he kicks the crap out of everyone.
Oh yeah. No, I agree. I feel like it was more influenced by Korean revenge thrillers rather than, kind of the Western action movies, although it does have a lot of great sequences. Yeah, I felt like the story could have been tightened up and there was some pacing issues. But, you know, for a first movie, I think Dev Patel did a really great job. Oh, and also with the underground fights, I love that they got Charlton Copley to be the bombastic MC who's like building everybody up. And he keeps on shitting on Dev Patel's character.
I love it when he shows up. Whenever he pops up, you know, at least this scene is going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. No, he brings the energy. But yeah, no, I really dug it overall, and it did have some pretty memorable sequences and fight choreography, like the bathroom brawl, and the finale was really cool. I dug it, and I look forward to whatever Dev Patel does next.
Yep. Speaking of Charlton Copley and revenge movies, it's kind of surprising that there's two of them coming out the same year. I saw Boy Kills World.
Ooh, yeah, I'm very excited for that. And no
it's
spoilers.
Funny it takes place in a universe that's kind of like the Hunger Games, where there's like this big government who goes and rounds up quote criminals and has them not even fight. It has them executed on a TV show, and the TV show that they're being executed on is like it's like high production value. It's like it's just meant for like entertainment with like the sponsors and stuff. And Charlton Copley is actually the host of the TV show that executes people. So
a real niche.
Yeah, he does. But it's your boy Bill Skarsgård, Korea, who he plays a character without a name, kind of like, you know, like a Clint Eastwood. Yeah, like a Clint Eastwood or a, you know, John Nada kind of a thing where he has a reason for revenge, too. And he's training. It's kind of a parallel to Monkey Man, actually. He's training.
Well, I also love that his inner monologue is H. John Benjamin.
Well, that's the thing. He's ever since the tragedy that happens to him, he goes deaf and mute. So, and he's saying, he's like, I don't remember what my real voice sounds like, so I took it from my favorite video game. So his internal narration is this, you know, it's like, all, and then I went after him, you know. it's pretty crazy, but it's a lot like Monkey Man. It's just, and Jessica Roth is like the opposite assassin of him, you know, from the person he's trying to get revenge on is Famke Janssen, who is like the leader of the family that he's, you know, trying to take down. But yeah, Jessica Roth, and she wears this helmet. It's kind of handy for him because her helmet across the front of it will show, like, you know, get out, you know, or, you know, it'll print words, so he doesn't have to read her lips. It's hilarious because at one point he meets an ally who he's having trouble reading his lips, so his internal monologue, the guy's speaking gibberish, and he says with his internal monologue, he's like, that can't be what he said. you don't understand a word this one character says because he's having trouble reading his lips. It's pretty funny. But anyway, yeah, Boy Kills World. If you like Monkey Man, you'll probably like Boy Kills World. It's a little more over the top than Monkey Man, if you can believe that. But yeah, like you said, we have a ton to talk about. So I'm gonna actually quick fire a few new things that I saw that I don't think you guys have. So just to get them out of the way. This is the movie Stop Motion, which is it's really different. It's about a woman who does stop motion movies, and her and she works with her mother. But she meets this little girl who basically gives her an idea for her own story. So she starts making her own. And of course, the stop motion comes to life on its own. But it's a pretty creepy little movie. It's really inventive, too. And it's about half stop motion. Well, a little less than half stop motion and half like real life. But stop motion is worth a watch as well. I saw a movie called Horny Teenagers Must Die, which you pretty much know what that's about. It's about a bunch of teenagers who go to the woods, and there's a killer out there, and every single character in this movie has sex. And, you know, it's just like the title says, horny teenagers must die. The reveal of the killer is actually kind of fun. So it is kind of worth it, but it just seems like a feature length, like student movie. So, you know, it's not super high, but the real fun one of the movies that of the quick fire ones I want to do is Sting. Have you guys heard about this?
Oh yeah, the spider movie,
giant spider movie. Yeah, it's about this little girl who crawls through the air conditioning ducts in her apartment building, breaks into other people's houses, you know, to do whatever. And she finds this little spider that right from the beginning, you know, this spider hatched from a meteorite that hit the earth. So, you know, it's an alien. Like that's the first.
Oh, boy.
So she finds it. And
it's an alien spider.
And yeah. And she names it Sting, not after the wrestler or the rock star, but after the little dagger from The Hobbit. So he has this little spider, and she's feeding it cockroaches, and then it starts growing. And soon cockroaches aren't enough for this thing. So it turns into like this massive giant spider, and it's a giant spider movie. It's got the spirit of like a Roger Corman monster movie, but with the visual effects and slickness of like a Blumhouse movie. So yeah, if that's your nice jam, creature features are, if you like creature features, Sting is cool. But another cool thing I saw, and I believe Jacob has seen this too, Sasquatch Sunset.
Yes.
This,
I love that movie,
is probably the weirdest movie you're gonna see this year. It's done by the guys who did Kamuko the Treasure Hunter.
The Zellner brothers.
And it basically is about a family of Sasquatches who they go through a year in their life, and there's not much of a story to it. Probably the biggest arc there is that man is encroaching on their land, because, you know, all of a sudden they start seeing spray painted X's on the trees, like, you know, because the loggers are coming, kind of a thing, you know. So they're like, oh, you know. And the thing is, two of the Sasquatches are Riley Keough and Jesse Eisenberg, and you can kind of tell from like their eyes, but they're in this massive Sasquatch makeup, but it really kind of tells you what the actors can really do with just their eyes and their body motions, because they kind of behave like apes and they communicate with like grunts and hoots and whistles, you know, things like that. But it is, oh my God, it is, it's a look into Sasquatch life. There is full frontal Sasquatch dong.
Yes. That's all I want in the cinema.
But no. But it's not what you think, Korea. This is not Bill Paxton and Taking Tiger Mountain. These are like, I mean, this is, just see it.
You had me at Sasquatch dong.
Yeah, no, this might be the greatest Sasquatch movie of all time because it's pure, unfiltered Sasquatch. Like, it's just the Sasquatches living their lives, getting attacked by animals or doing stupid shit, and also showing emotion to each other. Like, one of the other big arcs of the story is that the female Sasquatch becomes pregnant, and that becomes something they deal with. But yeah, there are so many Sasquatch fluids and grossness that happens in this movie. It's insane. But yeah, it's like a nature doc, you know, it's unfiltered.
Exactly. It's shot like a nature doc. It's beautiful Humboldt locations, and it really captures the beauty of the forest as well. But one of my favorite parts is they to go with the encroachment of man, they at one point they come across a logging road that comes through, and they're both like, and they walk out onto this road and they start like peeing on it and pooping on it and
just
like,
just spraying every bodily fluid possible.
But yeah, you do get to see a baby Sasquatch get born. The beauty of the circle of life. Yeah, it's a crazy movie, though. It is. I imagine it's a good double feature with Hundreds of Beavers, which I also did see and I loved.
Oh, yeah. I fucking love Hundreds of Beavers.
Oh, my God. It's a feature length Looney Tunes cartoon. It is so amazing. But anyway,
I've seen it twice and it's made me laugh so hard I've cried.
It's hilarious. We talked enough about Hundreds of Beavers when Jacob gave his review. I just wanted to say I concur with everything Jacob said about Hundreds of Beavers.
Thank you.
Well, I got a couple rapid fires because I've been playing catch up. Finally saw Beekeeper, and you guys were right. That movie's just
Protect the Hive.
Fun as fuck, dude.
Anybody who doesn't like Beekeeper is just, they just don't get the joke. Like, the movie gets the joke.
Yeah. Our friends over at Lethal Lullabies did a special screening for friends, and we had a blast with that. All sitting in our pajamas and whatnot. I got the new 4K for Cutthroat Island. Cutthroat Island just had I think it really just suffered from just like bad financial shit behind the scenes and stuff, because that movie's a lot of fun, and basically Pirates of the Caribbean ripped it off hard. So that's all I got to say about Cutthroat Island. Godzilla X Kong got me to finally watch the 1970s and 80s King Kong movies, which I gotta say, King Kong 76 is a lot of fun, but King Kong Lives is fucking unhinged. You have a Lady Kong, you have a Kong bird scene. Like, it sounds like that would make for a good double feature with Sasquatch Sunset, I gotta say.
It's King Kong Escapes where there's a robot Kong, right?
Yeah, that's the
Japanese one.
Yeah. King Kong Lives is the sequel to the 76.
Oh, to the Dino De Laurentiis one?
Yeah, where Linda Hamilton plays a scientist who's studying a comatose, because he got straight murked at the end of 76. So it's like, oh, yeah, no, he's in a comatose thing. But also, we found a female Kong. So, like, you know, now you're dealing with a horny Kong. And it's just like, it's unhinged, dude. That is a weird movie. I highly recommend it. I loved it. And I did my Lesbians Doing Crime double feature of Love Lies Bleeding and Driveway Dolls. Opposite end of spectrum when it comes to vibes, but the vibes were immaculate with both. I head over heels over both movies. I can't recommend them enough. Did you guys see Roadhouse?
I did not.
Well, this is just going to be Korea bitching then, because we all know how obsessed I am with Roadhouse. So Roadhouse remake happened. That was a thing. And we all know how obsessed I am with Roadhouse. It is unhealthy how much I love the original Patrick Swayze movie. So obviously tried to go in with as much of an open mind as possible. And the main things that you need to know going into Roadhouse is this is not Patrick Swayze Dalton. This is a very different Dalton. I love the Miami setting. I love the setup with a lot of that. There's a lot of really weird choices that are made. Like, instead of having a Sam Elliott character, like the kind of that character is kind of replaced with a child who's, it feels like her sole purpose was to point out that this story is kind of like a Western. And when I say that she does that, I mean, she literally says this is like a Western 4 fucking different times, which was very frustrating because it didn't need to be meta like that. The fight scenes are pretty good. There's some good stuff, but there's some like choices where it's so different that some of the Roadhouse references just like don't work, or they feel like they're forced in. Like, this was written as a different movie, and then someone's like, let's turn this into a Roadhouse remake. And they kind of do that. None of the philosophy of the original movie is in this. Conor McGregor, though, is a lot of fun because he's literally walking around like a live action Popeye villain and just like being weird and unhinged.
Well, that's how he walks in real life.
And that's how he sounds, too.
Yeah. You ever see him? If you see him in the ring at a UFC, he's.
But like, they give him like the cheesiest fucking lines. It's so weird. Oh, man. And as we all know, obsessed with Roadhouse, I am. And also obsessed with the line when Patrick Swayze is fighting the dude and the guy looks Swayze dead in the eyes and goes, I used to fuck guys like you in prison during the end big fight scene. That's replaced in this where they're fighting in the Roadhouse, which is called Roadhouse. Like, the actual Roadhouse is called the Roadhouse, which of course they talk about in the movie. But they're fighting and Conor McGregor slams Jake Gyllenhaal's head on a piano and Jake Gyllenhaal goes, this piano's out of tune. And Conor McGregor's like, I think it sounds perfect. And I'm like, that's what you replaced? That's what you replaced the I used to fuck guys like you in prison line with? Come on, guys. So Roadhouse, it's going to have its fans. It's not a bad movie. It's fun. It's just you really got to not forget the original movie, but just kind of go in just knowing like this isn't trying to be Roadhouse at all. It's doing its own thing. And that's fine for most people.
My question is, how do they replace the Jeff Healey band?
With a lot of various bands. They have multiple bands playing.
There's no house band?
No, they have a bunch of random ones. There's one point where it's a band playing Sublime, which was like cool. Yeah, like they did like their own like kind of like Florida cover of like Sublime. I dug that, but of course you can't top the Jeff Healey band. They were so good. But like,
well, and also the Jeff Healey, the blind guy playing guitar on his lap, it's just such a visual gimmick. I mean, and I know that's how he played guitar, so it wasn't written for the movie, but it's just so memorable. I mean, we're talking about it now.
Yeah, plus the band has that whole arc in the original Roadhouse where they learn to get better and not get bottles thrown at them.
Well, and that's the thing too. I think there's a lot of stuff where it's like it feels like there's an escalation, but the motivation is weird. Like in the original, it's like, this place is a dump, it needs to get cleaned up. And this one, it's like, no, this is a nice place, but these bad guys keep coming in. And so like, there's just like a weird, like the escalation doesn't feel like it matches often, but then it also kind of does. It's weird. Like, instead of Sam Elliott's character being killed in this one, like a bookstore gets burned down. And then like all of a sudden, like Jake Gyllenhaal's Dalton becomes a serial killer, like straight up, like he just starts murking people like a serial killer. And I was like, what the fuck? This is not my Dalton. And that's fine because he's not trying to be that Dalton. So and that's where it comes. Because like the original Roadhouse was all about philosophy and like, you know, be cool until it's time to not be cool. And this isn't that movie, which again, is fine for most people. I just, you know, it was fun. It had fun moments.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. Now,
Guy Ritchie's Inglourious Basterds. Oh my God.
Yes, that's totally what it is. It's like a naval Inglourious Basterds. And killing Nazis, we've said it before, but it bears repeating. Killing Nazis is never not fun to watch. So have you guys seen Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare? Yeah, it is. I mean, it's killing Nazis. And the thing is, it is supposedly a true story. I don't know how many liberties they took, but it is about the guy who Ian Fleming's a character in this. It's about the guy that he based his James Bond character on. So just one of those, you know, basically improvises, always gets done. You know, they even say, they're like, at one point the mission gets more complicated and they're like, okay, we tried to recall the mission, but we couldn't get a hold of him. But just so you know, the reason we picked these people is because they don't follow orders, you know? And at that point you're like, okay, they're going to get this done no matter what. But yeah, it's basically a rogue group that Churchill sends out, and he tells him, he's like, if you're arrested by the British, you're going to go to jail. If you're caught by the Nazis, you're going to be tortured and killed. You know, no one knows about this mission. I'm even going to deny it, you know, once you walk out this room, but this is what you need to do. And, you know, their mission is basically to blow up this supply boat that supplies the U-boats with supplies, so that the Americans can get across the Atlantic to help in the war. So it's a very vital mission that they're on, but it's crazy killing Nazis,
but it's fun. Like it's
good times. Oh yeah.
Is it just like a fun dad movie, or is it like a fun, like, action? You know what I mean?
I don't even think it's a dad movie. I mean, it's just a fun action movie. It's just, you know,
and nothing against dad movies. We all know how much I love a good dad movie. You know, Ford versus Ferrari is great, you know, but like there's a different level between like a dad World War II action movie and like an action movie. You know?
This is Guy Ritchie trying to do Tarantino. I think it has a little more of a sense of humor than Tarantino.
Wait, so it's Guy Ritchie doing Guy Ritchie then? Because I mean, that's basically how Guy Ritchie got his start, was like, yeah, hey, I'm British Tarantino, you know?
Well, that's the funny thing is Guy Ritchie, he played around with a few things, but now I think he's back to making Guy Ritchie movies, at least with this movie. I don't know what he'll do next, but yeah.
I mean, he's been kind of in that mode for a bit with like The Gentleman and you know, those type of movies. It really does feel like he is like, all right, I'm going back to what I'm known for. I think Aladdin broke him a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. And let's end with killing Nazis. So we'll this has been a big catch up episode because, like I say, we missed an episode in the wrong time of the year. But here we go. I think we're all caught up now.
Yep.
Our theme song is by Restless Spirit. So go give them a listen. And our artwork is by Chris Fisher. Go give him a like. You can find us on any of the socials under Ion Horror or at ihorror.com, which is the website we all call home. And yeah, reach out to us at any time. Let us know. Did we miss anything that you've seen that we didn't? Do you like these catch-up episodes? I do. I really like these. Not that I have anything against our topic episodes, and I definitely don't have anything against our interview episodes, but I like these just, you know, sitting around and bullshitting about movies. You know,
it's what it's all about.
That's our log line. Ion Horror, sitting around bullshitting about movies.
It's what we do.
It's funny. We always joke that, and I'm not saying we're going to, but if we ever do a Patreon, we're going to just record all of the times that we are not recording, where we just sit around and bullshit about movies. The stuff that doesn't make the podcast is just as interesting.
No, it's not. We're not interesting.
No, I said just as interesting. I didn't say that the podcast itself is interesting. All right, everybody. We will see you in a couple of weeks, hopefully, unless we take an unplanned break again. But yeah, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. So for me, James J. Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
And I'm Jonathan Correa.
Keep your eye on horror.